Hello, and welcome to Silver Threads, a weekly program of information on how you can make your senior year shine. I'm Kathy Van Skoik. Last week in the program, How Long Do You Want to Live?, I introduced you to Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel, author of the Atlantic article, Why I Want to Die at 75, which I will finish reading today, followed by the LA Times article, Why Ezekiel Emanuel is Wrong to Hope for Death at 75, by Michael Hiltzik, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author who has written for the Los Angeles Times for 3 decades. So, Emanuel's premise in the first part of the article focuses on the negatives of living beyond 75, including functional limitations, dementia, and prolonged dying process as opposed to living fully, mental slowing, and loss of creativity. Today, I'm going to pick up where I left off with a discussion of mentoring. Mentorship is hugely important. It lets us transmit our collective memory and draw on the wisdom of elders. It is too often undervalued, dismissed as a way to occupy seniors who refuse to retire and who keep repeating the same stories. But it also illuminates a key issue with aging, the constricting of our ambitions and expectations. We accommodate our physical and mental limitations. Our expectations shrink. Aware of our diminishing capacities, we choose ever more restricted activities and projects to ensure we can fulfill them. Indeed, this constriction happens almost imperceptibly. Over time and without our conscious choice, we transform our lives. We don't notice that we are aspiring to and doing less and less. And so we remain content, but the canvas is now tiny. The American immortal, once a vital figure in his or her profession and community, is happy to cultivate avocational interests, to take up birdwatching, bicycle riding, pottery, and the like. And then, as walking becomes harder and the pain of arthritis limits the fingers' mobility, life becomes a centering around sitting in the den, reading or listening to books on tape, and doing crossword puzzles. And then, well, maybe this is too dismissive. There is more to life than youthful passion focused on career and creating. There is posterity, children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. But here, too, living as long as possible has drawbacks we often won't admit to ourselves. I will leave aside the very real and oppressive financial and caregiving burdens that many, if not most, adults in their so-called sandwich generation are now experiencing, caught between the care of children and parents. Our living too long places real emotional weights on our progeny. Unless there has been terrible abuse, no child wants his or her parent to die. It is a huge loss at any age. It creates a tremendous, unfillable hole. But parents also cast a big shadow for most children. Whether estranged, disengaged, or deeply loving, they set expectations, render judgments, impose their opinions, interfere, and are generally a looming presence for even adult children. This can be wonderful. It can be annoying. It can be destructive. But it is inescapable as long as the parent is alive. Examples abound in life and literature. Lear, the quintessential Jewish mother, the tiger mom. And while children can never fully escape this weight even after a parent dies, there is much less pressure to conform to parental expectations and demands after they are gone. Living parents also occupy the role of head of family. They make it hard for grown children to become the patriarch or matriarch. When parents routinely live to 95, children must caretake into their own retirement. That doesn't leave much of their time on their own. And it is all about old age. When parents live to 75, children have had the joys of a rich relationship with their parents, but also have enough time for their own lives out of their parents' shadows. But there is something even more important than parental shadowing. Memories. How do we want to be remembered by our children and grandchildren? We wish our children to remember us in our prime, active, vigorous, engaged, animated, astute, enthusiastic, funny, warm, and loving. Not stooped and sluggish, forgetful and repetitive, constantly asking, "What did she say?" We want to be remembered as independent, not experienced as burdens. At age 75, we reach that unique, albeit somewhat arbitrary, chosen moment when we have lived a rich and complete life and have hopefully imparted the right memories to our children. Living the American Immortal's dream dramatically decreases the chances that we will not get our wish, that memories of vitality will be crowded out by the agonies of decline. Yes, with effort, our children will be able to recall that great family vacation, that funny scene at Thanksgiving, that embarrassing faux pas at the wedding. But the most recent years, the years with progressing disabilities and need to make more caregiving arrangements, will inevitably become the predominant and salient memories. The old joys have to be actively conjured up. Of course, our children won't admit it. They love us and fear the loss that will be created by our death, and a loss it will be, a huge loss. They don't want to confront our mortality, and they certainly don't want to wish for our death. But even if we manage not to become burdens to them, our shadowing them until their old age is also a loss. And leaving them and our grandchildren with memories framed not by our vivacity, but by our frailty is the ultimate tragedy. 75, that's all I want to live. But if I am not going to engage in euthanasia or suicide, and I won't, is this all just idle chatter? Don't I lack the courage of my convictions? No, my view does have important principle and practical implications. One personal, two policy. Once I have lived at 75, my approach to my health care will completely change. I won't actively end my life, but I won't try to prolong it either. Today, when the doctor recommends a test or treatment, especially one that will extend our lives, it becomes incumbent upon us to give a good reason why we don't want it. The momentum of medicine and family means we will almost invariably get it. My attitude flips this default on its head. I take guidance from what Sir William Osler wrote in his classic turn-of-the-century medical textbook, The Principles and Practice of Medicine. Pneumonia may well be called the friend of the aged. Taken off by it in an acute, short, not often painful illness, the old man escapes those cold gradations of decay, so distressing to himself and to his friends. My Osler-inspired philosophy is this. At 75 and beyond, I will need a good reason to even visit the doctor and take any medical test or treatment, no matter how routine and painless. And that good reason is not it will prolong my life. I will stop getting any regular preventive tests, screenings, or interventions. I will accept only palliative, not curative treatments if I am suffering pain or other disability. This means colonoscopies and other cancer screening tests are out and before 75. If I were diagnosed with cancer now at 57, I would probably be treated unless the prognosis was very poor. But 65 will be my last colonoscopy, no screening for prostate cancer at any age. When a urologist gave me a PSA test, even after I said I wasn't interested, and called me with the results, I hung up before he could tell me. He ordered the test for himself, I told him, not for me. After 75, if I develop cancer, I will refuse treatment. Similarly, no cardiac stress test, no pacemaker, and certainly no implantable defibrillator. No heart valve replacement or bypass surgery. If I develop emphysema or some similar disease that involves frequent exacerbations that would normally land me in the hospital, I will accept treatment to ameliorate the discomfort caused by the feeling of suffocation, but I will refuse to be hauled off. What about simple stuff? Flu shots are out, certainly. If there were to be a flu pandemic, a younger person who has yet to live a complete life ought to get the vaccine or any antiviral drugs. The big challenge is antibiotics for pneumonia or skin and urinary infections. Antibiotics are cheap and largely effective in curing infections. It is really hard for us to say no. Indeed, even people who are sure they don't want life-extending treatments find it hard to refuse antibiotics. But as Osler reminds us, unlike the decays associated with chronic conditions, death from these infections is quick and relatively painless. So, no antibiotics. Obviously, a do not resuscitate order and a complete advance directive indicating no ventilators, dialysis, surgery, antibiotics, or any other medication. Nothing except the recorded. And palliative care, even if I am conscious but not mentally competent, and have been written and recorded. In short, no life-sustaining interventions. I will die when whatever comes first takes me. As far as policy is concerned, implication relates to biomedical research. We need more research on Alzheimer's, the growing disabilities of old age and chronic conditions, not on prolonging the dying process. Many people, especially those sympathetic to the American immortal, will recoil and reject my view. They will think of every exception as if they prove that the central theory is wrong. Like my friends, they will think me crazy, posturing, or worse, they might condemn me as being against the elderly. Again, let me be clear. I am not saying that those who want to live as long as possible are unethical or wrong. I'm certainly not scorning or dismissing people who want to live on despite their physical and mental limitations. I am not even trying to convince anyone I'm right. Indeed, I often advise people in this age group on how to get the best medical care available in the United States for their ailments. That is their choice, and I want to support them. And I am not advocating 75 as the official statistic of complete good life in order to save resources, ration health care, or address public policy issues arising from the increases in life expectancy. What I am trying to do is delineate my views for a good life and make my friends and others think about how they want to live as they grow older. I want them to think of an alternative to succumbing to that slow constriction of activities and aspirations imperceptibly imposed by aging. Are we to embrace the American immortal or my 75 and no more view? I think the rejection of my view is literally natural. After all, evolution has inculcated in us a drive to live as long as possible. We are programmed to struggle to survive. Consequently, most people feel there is something vaguely wrong about saying 75 and no more. We are eternally optimistic, Americans who chafe at limits, especially limits imposed on our own lives. We are sure we are exceptional. I also think my view conjures up spiritual and existential reasons for people to scorn and reject it. Many of us have suppressed, actively or passively, thinking about God, heaven and hell, and whether we return to the worms. We are agnostics or atheists or just don't think about whether there is a God and why she should care at all about mere mortals. We also avoid constantly thinking about the purpose of our lives and the mark we will leave. Is making money, chasing the dream, all worth it? Indeed, most of us have found a way to live our lives comfortably without acknowledging, much less answering, these big questions on a regular basis. We have gotten into productive routines that help ignore them, and I don't purport to have those answers. But 75 defines a clear point in time. For me, 2032. It removes the fuzziness of trying to live as long as possible. It specifically forces us to think about the end of our lives and engage with the deepest existential questions and ponder what we want to leave our children and grandchildren, our community, our fellow Americans, the world. The deadline also forces us, each of us, to ask whether our consumption is worth our contribution. As most of us learned in college during late-night bull sessions, these questions foster deep anxiety and discomfort. The specificity of 75 means we can no longer just continue to ignore them and maintain our easy, socially acceptable agnosticism. For me, 18 more years with which to wade through these questions is preferable to years of trying to hang on to every additional day and forget the psychic pain they bring up while enduring the physical pain of an elongated dying process. 75 years is all I want to live. I want to celebrate my life while I am still in my prime. My daughters and dear friends will continue to try to convince me that I am wrong and can live a valuable life much longer. And I retain the right to change my mind and offer a vigorous and reasoned defense of living as long as possible. That, after all, would mean I still am being creative after 75. Well, now we're going on to Michael Hiltzik from the LA Times, why Ezekiel Emanuel is wrong to hope for death at 75. Dr. Emanuel, eminent oncologist and medical sage, policy advisor to the Obama White House, outspoken defender of the Affordable Care Act, has roiled the political and policy communities, both left and right, with an essay in The Atlantic declaring that he hopes to die at age 75. Emanuel's subject is our inability to accept the inevitability of decline and death. He disavows any intention to set forth general principles either for individuals or American society. I'm not saying that those who want to live as long as possible are unethical or wrong, he writes. I'm not even trying to convince anyone I'm right. Yet he protests too much. Plainly, he aimed for his piece to be provocative in the sense of enlivening a public debate about aging, death, and public policy. And of course, he's advocating. This manic desperation to endlessly extend life is misguided and potentially destructive, he writes. If he's not trying to convince his readers that he's right and the counter-arguments are wrong, why publish the piece at all? Emanuel's essay is provocative, all right, not because its ideas are thought-provoking, but purely because of Emanuel's position as a prominent figure in a national debate about health care policy. At its heart, it's profoundly misguided, profoundly vain, and profoundly inhumane. It addresses our debate about society's resources and its treatment of old versus young without shedding new light on the topics. That's a lost opportunity and a shame, because many scholars and policymakers have been thinking about this question for years. Any analysis of Emanuel's essay must start with the narrowness of his personal perspective. His conviction that he will surely have lived a complete existence by 75 reflects the experience of an upper-middle-class gentleman whose life and career paths have been smoothed by a superb education and the environment of family accomplishment. His brothers are Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel and Hollywood talent agent Ari Emanuel. He's on the faculty of the University of Pennsylvania, which will presumably support him, if necessary, in an emeritus capacity, as long as he wishes. Today, he's a vigorous 57 without any known chronic or latent diseases. He says he doesn't intend deliberately to end his life at 75, but rather to cease accepting medical interventions at that point. Nothing, that is, except pain relief or other palliatives. No colonoscopies, cancer screening or treatment, cardiac tests or surgeries. Not even antibiotics or flu shots. Though getting a shot might make unnecessary the palliatives he might need if he contracts the flu. One question posed by this pledge is whether it's enforceable. Zeke Emanuel 57 is committing Zeke Emanuel 75 to a lifestyle that the latter Zeke may not, in the fullness of time, find acceptable. Such a reality created some embarrassment for medical ethicist Daniel Callahan, who proposed in 1987, at age 58, setting limits on health care for seniors. Yet, in his late 70s, he underwent an $80,000 treatment for a heart condition. He said he wasn't aware of the cost at the time. We are very different persons at different stages of our lives, and our own evolving perspectives can make it impossible to bind our own selves to our own resolutions. Today, Zeke Emanuel is convinced that by 75, he will have lived a life sufficiently fulfilled to shed it at nature's command. But that Zeke Emanuel may have a different perspective. By the time I reach 75, I will have lived a complete life, he declares today. How could he know that 2 decades in advance? Emanuel's chief target is the conviction of many Americans that they can lead a fulfilled life after 75 and deserve to do so. Emanuel ascribes this notion to a group he calls the American Immortals. He implies that they're hopelessly naive and worse, that they impose insupportable costs on society in their quest to extend their lives. The fact is that by 75, creativity, originality, and productivity are pretty much gone for the vast, vast majority of us, he writes. Those whose lives contradict this finding are merely outliers. With those words, Emanuel casually dismisses the essential variability of human life. To narrow so drastically the range of contributions to life and society we define as worthy is to overlook the glorious richness of the mature mind. Giuseppe Verdi wrote 2 unique masterpieces, Otello and Falstaff, at 69 and 74, inspired by collaboration with a youthful librettist, Arrigo Boito. Thomas Pynchon, whose prose crackles with the energy of a 20-year-old, published his monumental Against the Day at age 69 and followed up with Inherent Vice at 72 and Bleeding Edge at 76. Pynchon's near contemporary Philip Roth published one of his finest novels, The Haunting and Harrowing Nemesis, at age 77. In the policy of the public sphere, federal appeals judge Richard Posner is still setting down compelling principles of law at 75, and U.S. District Judge Jed Rakoff is fighting ferocious battles for justice from the New York bench at 71. Neither shows any sign of slowing down, and society would be poorer if they did. The real issues Emanuel's essay raises are economic. That's where its implications are broadest and where it's the most misguided. By couching his arguments for death at 75 in spiritual and emotional terms, Emanuel evades direct confrontation with economics. Except briefly, at one point he mentions the very real and oppressive financial and caregiving burdens of the sandwich generation, caring for children and parents simultaneously. And at another, proposes that Americans at 75 ask whether our consumption is worth our contribution. But the economic underpinning of Emanuel's viewpoint is inescapable. If aging didn't impose costs on society, who would care whether anyone decided to shed or sustain his or her mortal coil at 75? It would be an individual and inconsequential decision unworthy of a major essay in, say, The Atlantic. Instead, Emanuel's essay feeds into an enduring conundrum known to ethicists as the duty to die. Put briefly, the idea is that elders should step aside for rising generation, freeing up society's resources to nurture children and allow our younger workers to thrive. In politics, this was expressed most notably in 1984 by then Colorado Governor Dick Lam, who said at a meeting of health lawyers that seniors have got a duty to die and get out of the way. Let the other society, our kids, build a reasonable life. But it lives on today in talk of generational theft and generational warfare. Usually the context is the cost of programs for retirees, such as Medicare and Social Security, which is decried as a drain on the federal government, which consequently spends less on the needs of children. Well, we've addressed this argument before, observing that most government spending on children comes in the form of spending on education by states and localities, which balances the books. More importantly, nothing about spending on seniors prevents American society from spending much more on children or young families. America has more than enough resources to spend all we want on programs for citizens at all stages of life. If there's an imbalance in spending on seniors versus children, that's a political choice we're making, not a fiscal imperative. As philosopher Christine Overall observes, even if there are genuine problems of resource scarcity, it ought not be assumed that age rationing is the only method of responding to them, especially when age rationing entails coercive pressures on older people to die. And is there genuine scarcity? No, she writes, only an assumption that health care is a sealed envelope to which no new funds can be added, not from reducing military spending or handouts to big corporations or any other sources. His words would apply equally to Emmanuel's case. Emmanuel doesn't even examine whether living longer will bankrupt society and lead to lives of pain and misery. He appears to accept those notions as givens. Emmanuel's ruminations on mortality lack the empathy that might tell him that the conditions of aging he describes, faltering and declining, a state that may not be worse than death, but is nonetheless deprived, feeble, ineffectual, even pathetic, are not universal, and that even those who suffer from them might not want to give up their last years. Instead, what comes through is Emmanuel's terror of losing even a small measure of capacity. He turns an anecdote about his own 87-year-old father, who describes himself as living a happy life, and by Emmanuel's account is independent, physically vigorous, and mentally and emotionally engaged, into one about a man overstaying his time on earth because no one would say he is living a vibrant life. Sounds like his father would contradict him. Mortality can be a treacherous subject, writes the physician Atul Gawande in his latest book, Being Mortal. Gawande, whose subject also is the inevitability of decline and death, but doesn't think in terms of artificial deadlines, observes that we lack a coherent view of how people might live successfully to their very end. Well, I want to leave you with these thoughts from author Marion Dane Bauer's blog entry, Why I Don't Want to Die at 75. Just thinking. Do I want to go on living when my life is reduced to pain or a radical loss of comprehension? No. And that is no doubt part of what Dr. Emmanuel was reacting to, our medical system's ability to keep us alive long past the time when we're of any use, not just to the world around us, but to ourselves. It's a profound problem and one we must find better solutions for. But while I hope we work seriously and with deep love on that failure of our medical system, I also hope we don't forget that life is about more than being useful. We are important, each one of us, simply because we are, even when it is time for us to receive more than we can give. Because receiving is another way of giving. The giver grows in the giving, and the truth is we all need to hold close at any time to life. Thanks for listening, and until next week, I'm Kathy Van Skoik. You've been listening to Silver Threads, a production of WXXI Reach Out Radio in Rochester, New York. The audio producer for the show is Maureen Rich, and I'm Kathy Van Skoik. I hope you'll join me again next week for more information and updates for making the best of your silver years. If you'd like to hear this program again, you can download a podcast of the show at our website, wxxi.org.